From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The action by the Congress to put these sanctions in place in the way they did, neither the president nor I are very happy about that.
That was U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson on Tuesday, referring to sanctions against Iran, Russia, and North Korea, which passed both houses of Congress this week by huge margins.
We were clear that we didn't think it was going to be helpful to our efforts, but that's the decision they made. They made it in a very overwhelming way. I think the president accepts that.
The vote in the House was 419-3, and in the Senate, 98-2. Clear, veto-proof majorities. The president did raise questions about the constitutionality of several provisions of the bill in his signing statement. For more on that, we spoke with our regular political commentator, Professor Tony Montero. So, Tony, it's a pleasure to have you with us, and what a weird week. Damn.
Yeah. Another weird week in a series of weird weeks.
You can say that again. Wow.
And even though they say that bringing in General Kelly as chief of staff is an attempt to bring some order to the White House staff and to shut down a lot of the internal conflicts in the White House, I think part of what they bring this guy on for is to seal the leaks in the White House.
Yeah. And
if you listen closely, what Trump was most concerned with Priebus was his inability to seal the leaks from within the White House that were finding their way into the media and congressional hearings and probably Robert Mueller's investigation.
Yeah.
The White House was porous, and they had to, really, they had to bring in somebody who could find out where this was coming from. And that's not, in saying this, you know, a lot of people usually get this confused. They think in saying something like this, oh, you're defending Trump and his policies. No, you're not
right.
Defending Trump and his policies. You were saying that an illegal, slow-moving coup d'etat was underway and that there were people in and outside of the White House, and in particular in the deep state, who were going to make it impossible for Donald Trump, the duly elected president, to govern or even to put forward a vision for governance and, in that sense, domestic and foreign policy. So if you look at the domestic side, it has been defeat after defeat in terms of the Republican-controlled House and Senate. And the big one was repeal and replace, you know, so that, you know, he could not govern with the support of a majority Republican Senate and a majority Republican House. So that he's trumped, excuse the pun, on the domestic side. And now with these sanctions, the Congress as a whole, it's as unbelievable, is saying that this president cannot be allowed to conduct foreign policy. And these wild sanctions against everything standing, including Germany and the European Union.
Yeah.
This is unprecedented and unbelievable. And the question is, where are they going with this? And I think, finally, what I would say, the only place this is going is to some form of the removal of Donald Trump from office. And they're building up a situation to where there will be a showdown at some point in this presidency. Probably, I would suggest, in early 2018, where, it'll be the big showdown. And it won't be through impeachment necessarily. It'll be through, I think, the Congress moving aggressively in an unconstitutional way to eviscerate this presidency and the presidency itself going forward.
You know, I'm looking at the legislation that Congress passed, that Trump just signed, I think, yesterday. This is countering America's Adversaries Through Sanctions Act.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And there's a vote in Congress, first in the House, 419-3. That means there were 13 people that either abstained or voted present or, you know, were absent. Mm-hmm. Then in the Senate, 98-2. You know, as I said to you before, I don't think you would get that kind of unanimity if they were voting for pay raises for themselves, okay, knowing mm-hmm. who these people are, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a statement there of, policy, essentially, coming from the establishment with one voice across the aisles. Mm-hmm. All those things that they tell people that are Democratic district leaders and carry petitions and everything about the Republicans, how horrible they are. Everything that they tell the Republicans who carry petitions and are district leaders about how terrible the Democrats are. This particular thing, this policy, is something that they all stand together on. And what that policy actually is, it's stated in like one sentence in Section 253 under a title, Statement of Policy, and this has to do with the sanctions against Russia. The United States, consistent with the principle of ex injuria jus non oritur, expresses the policy known as the, quote, Stimson Doctrine, closed quote, and thus does not recognize territorial changes effected by force, including the illegal invasions and occupations of Abkhazia, South Ossetia, Crimea, Eastern Ukraine, and Transnistria. In other words, with the exception of Eastern Ukraine, there are these parts of the Russian Federation that the United States says it doesn't recognize.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Policy, and that's a point, essentially, that Congress stepped out of its constitutional role to push down the throat of the Trump administration, in essence, as a statement from the so-called deep state, with the intelligence agencies, all 17 of them, or however damn many they say there are, speaking with one voice and manipulating events to effectuate this. This is the core of their problem. There are territorial issues with Russia. They claim this part of Russia ain't yours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in fact, it's an overstep. They're getting involved in the internal matters of the post-Soviet space.
Right.
It involves all kind of political issues and legal issues. Of course, Georgia attempted to resolve these political issues by force of arms.
Yep.
And now what is left of Georgia is trying to become a part of NATO. So here you're going to have NATO inside of Russia itself, or the post-Soviet space itself. These, in effect, constitute a form of a declaration of war against Russia,
right,
as an illegal and rogue regime, which the United States will unilaterally, without the UN Security Council or even without the NATO Council or the European Union. I mean, there's no international body that endorses this move on the part of the United States. I mean, this is huge. I mean, and when you read the Defense Authorization Bill for 2017, and you look very closely, once again, the doctrine of first strike use of nuclear weapons against Russia is included in that bill. And you know, let us not forget that under the Obama administration, the program of the nuclear modernization was begun, and that's over $1 trillion, right, to improve the capacity for first strike. You know, I just want to say to people, you know, when they talk about defensive weapons, weapons to so-called shoot down incoming missiles from another country, really what they're saying, because these defensive weapons don't stand alone, is that it is part of a first strike strategy.
Right.
That you have the capacity to hit your opponents with a first strike and then to defend against the opponent's incoming retaliatory missiles.
Right.
So it's all first strike. I mean, the nuclear modernization program is part of a first strike, in particular, against Russia.
Yeah, and so if you revisit everything that we've been talking about, looking at it through that prism, you have, in essence, the political, with the attacks on Trump over Russiagate, quote-unquote, legal, with the law that they just passed, whether it stands up to constitutional muster or not, is something we probably wouldn't find out until after a nuclear war. and then the actual material basis for conducting a nuclear war. So you have the political environment, you know, being prepared, the legal environment being prepared, and the weaponry being prepared.
That, absolutely,
that goes someplace, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And this is why part of the resistance, and I put quotes around that, if it is to be that, has to be connected to an anti-war movement and the development of a politics that opposes war, and especially nuclear war with Russia. And that is why, again, the left's involvement with the anti-Trump movement, you know, right after the election, was really badly advised. It was so ridiculous and so wrong politically, and now we see it in full bloom. I mean, we had said this is a movement coming from corporate Democrats, in particular the Hillary Clinton forces within the Democratic Party and the deep state. Right. And here it is right in front of your face. But this is the intrigue of Washington and politicians and the ruling elite. It is not resonating with the American people. The Democrats, if a presidential election were held today, would probably lose, and probably to Donald Trump, because the people do not see any of this stuff that the Democrats are doing as related to the conditions of their lives. And those conditions are worsening. And we have to keep our eye on that. The conditions of the people of the United States, especially the working class and the poor, which is over half of the U.S. working population and the population in general, right, the conditions have worsened. And this palace intrigue and this internal struggle for power and to oust Trump and to make impossible negotiated peace in Syria or a reset of the relationship with Russia, all of that is now off the table. But the other thing I might add is that if you thought that Trump was the worst of all possible worlds in terms of war and belligerency, read this sanctions bill, especially as it relates to North Korea. And this was voted on by almost every Democrat in the Senate and in the House of Representatives. And that bill gives the United States, the right, and here we're talking about the United States Congress, can vote to go to war with North Korea. And very interestingly, it will be the first time that a president or the Congress fulfilled its constitutional duty to be the only part of government that can declare war. So now, in a ironic twist, the U.S. Senate and House is assuming its responsibility over taking the nation to war in order to diminish Trump's ability to negotiate for peace anywhere in the world, or to continue what we have called the imperial retreat. And that's what we... So you listen to Congresswoman Maxine Waters, who justifies her vote on that bill by saying that Trump is soft on North Korea. I think that tells us everything. So interestingly, this is a Democratic Party initiative. Bipartisan, but it is the Democrats who were in the forefront and are in the forefront of these sanctions and this new aggressiveness towards Russia, Iran, and North Korea.
You know, you have what is for many a moment of dissonance over just that fact that it's the Democrats that are, playing the role of warmonger. Those of us who've been paying attention to this don't have that dissonance. No. But with the public image, it is dissonant. And the other thing that you have, though, that's very interesting, almost with symmetry. You've had with the rise of what was called, going back as far as Nixon at least, the imperial presidency, right, with people going to war without congressional authorization. That the president had done his body of law that recognized or bestowed, I think is a more accurate way, unilateral power on the president to, go to war for a period of time, and then the War Powers Act and courts whittling away at that. So you have, on the one hand, like presidents almost unrestrained by Congress in going to war, and Congress more or less abdicating its role there, on the one hand. On the other, circumscribing the president's ability to make peace.
Right.
And removing the ability to negotiate, leaving only the power to conduct war.
And this is really what they're saying also at the initiative of the Congress.
Right.
That the president does not have, first of all, it is the whittling down of the imperial presidency. And as you point out, which is this overreach constitutionally and politically of the presidency from the time of Nixon. And of course, I think most egregiously implemented through Bill Clinton and Barack Obama and George Bush's presidency.
Right.
Now they're whittling it back because you have a president who wants to reset the imperial agenda, and I think is in effect, with all kinds of contradictions and stuff, involved in imperial retreat, at least from the military being the first option in relationships with nations like Iran and North Korea and Russia. Now, people will say, well, what about his statements on Iran, that he wanted always to go to war with Iran, and his statements on North Korea? I think what we know about Donald Trump and his statements is that his statements are so contradictory that you really have to look at what is going on the ground. And I think that's why the Syria agreement with Russia is so very important as a gesture and as a symbolic act about the Trump White House's attitude towards Russia and working with Russia for peace in Syria, which in many ways still disrupts the policy of encircling in the Middle East Iran. So it's not so simple. The other thing is that it does not appear from statements coming from people in the Trump administration that even the generals are advising war with North Korea for reasons that we have talked about so often here. It doesn't make sense. It would devastate a big part of the world economy. It would, of course, and devastate South Korea and Japan, the third and fifth largest economies in the world.
Right.
So they the tens of millions of people that could potentially be killed and nuclear and pollute the environment of Northeast Asia with nuclear fallout for decades and years to come. I mean, it's the craziest thing. But when you talk about war rhetoric and the party of war, the war rhetoric is more belligerent coming from the Democrats, including members of the Black Congressional Caucus, mm-hmm. and from the Democratic Party than from the Republican Party. It is a ironic reversal.
And then you talk about the, essentially, with reference to Trump, you know, the way my grandfather would say, you know, watch the hands. In other words, forget what comes out of the mouth because it's so contradictory. Doing that, okay, we had Pence. He's the one that'll be president if these people that want to remove Trump are successful, unless they, you know, Agnew him out first and then we get Ryan, indistinguishable. But Pence was in Monday in Tallinn in Estonia first, early in the day, and then in Tbilisi in Georgia later in the day. In each place, in Tallinn, he had the heads of government of Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia. You look at a map of the former Soviet Union or of the world, Russia. Look at Russia up on the top left-hand side. You got these three little republics that are there that were part of Russia 400 years or better before the Russian Revolution and yada, yada, yada. The United States is now, they're part of NATO. Pence is there. On Sunday, they kicked off a military exercise there named Iron Wolf 2017 with about 5,300 troops from 10 NATO countries intended to test the capabilities of Germany's Forward Presence Battalion Battle Group. Now, the same people that brought through Operation Barbarossa. So that's going on that part of the Russian border. You also had with Georgia, now you're at the bottom left, Noble Partners, the name of that particular exercise, kicked off near Tbilisi on Sunday. Those drills will run for 2 weeks. They got 2,800 military personnel from NATO and their partners, and three former Soviet republics, Armenia, Ukraine, and Georgia, taking part. Even though they're not formal members, they are part of that. These are part of 18 drills being held in seven countries in the Black Sea region next to Russia's border. And that is part of stuff including Saber Guardian 2017 in Hungary, Romania, and Bulgaria. That's 25,000 troops. You have Seabreeze 17 naval drills off the coast of Ukraine, which is also off the coast of Russia. All of this at the same time that they're passing legislation that says we don't recognize your occupation of this, that, or the other part of the country that happens to be within the sights of our guns right now. That's what the hands are doing.
And this is the very opposite of what appeared in the early part of this Trump presidency and certainly in the campaign.
Right.
To be a reset of relations with Russia, and the Putin government had looked forward to negotiating a reset with the Trump administration. And that is why they did not respond in kind to Obama's sanctions and kicking out of a whole number of Russian diplomats right at the end of his presidency in, right. in I think, December.
Yeah, December.
I mean, this we cannot continue to think of the Democratic Party as the liberal party. It is liberal only in the sense of it has this kind of veil, this brand of liberalism. It's liberal when it comes to identity politics, but it is the party of war in substance. It is the party of the defense of American empire. You know, the question becomes, you know, to Bernie Sanders and others on the left wing of the corporate Democrats, you know, how can you not challenge this war policy and then on the other hand say that you want all of these social programs and investment in the people in terms of health care and infrastructure development? You can't have both. Like Martin Luther King said, war, and I would add preparation for war, is the enemy of the poor and of the working class in general. And that is why, you know, Don, it is so interesting that on the ground, working people and the middle classes, as they are called, instinctively know that all of this internal battling within Washington and certainly talk of war and preparation for war, and as you just recounted, all of these military exercises on the borders of Russia, and then add to that the nuclear modernization program that we just spoke about.
Yep.
The majority of people in this country know that that has nothing to do with them.
Right.
And in fact, these policies go against their interests.
Yeah, it's picking their pockets. That's about their only involvement with it, is that the money that they would have for food, clothing, shelter, healthcare, education is instead being squandered on these things that they appear to want to use to blow up the world.
Yeah. So the majority of the American people are without a party, are without a party that represents their interest. And again, Don, you know, you and I have been talking about this for some time, and almost until we've become blue in the face.
Right.
And hopefully somebody is listening somewhere, because we said it, that the Trump candidacy would break up the Republican Party, and that the Sanders candidacy would be the beginning of the breakup of the Democratic Party. The system of party rule and party governance is no longer operative, is no longer functional. And the thing is, the vast majority of the American people are moving away from both of the corporate parties. And they're just right now in no man's land politically, but they are angry at the elites. And that anger is what elected Trump, for the most part, as well as the terrible conditions of the working people. And that anger has intensified up to this point where people are angry and livid. They don't trust politicians. And frankly, they feel that the government is against them rather than representative of them.
And we know that that's a pretty toxic mixture, and we're going to be watching that as time passes. Certainly, it's getting more and more interesting, if scary, as time goes on. Thank you, Tony.
Absolutely.
Appreciate your
Thank
time.
You.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.